According to Robert P. Jones, author of White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity, he said, racism among white American Christians is higher than among the non-religious. A close read of history reveals that we white Christians have not just been complacent or complicit. Rather, as the nation's dominant cultural power, we have constructed and sustained a project of perpetuating white supremacy that has framed the entire American story. The legacy of this unholy union still lives in the DNA of white Christians today, and not just among white evangelicals in the South, but also among white mainline Protestants in the Midwest and white Catholics in the Northeast. The unsettling truth, he says, is not that for, or is that for nearly all of American history, the light-skinned Jesus conjured up by most white congregations was not merely indifferent to the status quo of racial inequality. He demanded its defense and preservation as part of the natural, divinely ordained order of things. Canadian Christian history is also not without guilt when it comes to racism. In particular, our treatment of First Nations demonstrates a fundamental belief that while all races may be welcomed into the benefits of salvation, in this life, God has favored the white races over the savage natives and destined that we, Christian European descendants, would receive the gift of land along with the natural resources that had long since been enjoyed by others, others that we refer to as heathens. And with holy conquest complete, it was considered the duty of white Christians to quote-unquote, civilize and Christianize the darker-skinned First Peoples in order to assimilate them into white Christian society. But wait, isn't Christianity all about love and peace and goodwill and grace and freedom and inclusion and acceptance and servanthood and caring for the less fortunate and equality? Well, yes, it is if you want it to, but the religion of the Bible can also be seen as exclusive, condemning, shunning, misogynistic, disciplinarian, racist, segregationist, and condoning slavery and fostering a perpetual warrior mentality. So this got me to wondering, why is it, if it is true, that white Christians are more likely to be racist than non-Christians? Secondly, does that bother us? Are we troubled by that fact? Thirdly, is the Bible itself a collection of racist writings? Since most of what is referred to as white Christian nationalism draws justification or actual instruction from the Word of God. And fourth, is what we call racism actually not racism according to the Bible? Maybe the culture that we live in is too soft, too permissive, too inclusive, and will not tolerate things that the Bible identifies as good and at times necessary, such as slavery and genocide. After all, does not the Bible command that the nations should be kept separate and that the races should not mix? Certainly there are passages in the Old Testament that indicate that, but even in Acts 17:26, it says, "From one man, he, that is God, made every nation of men, that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he is the one that determined their appointed times, when they would exist, when they would have power, when they would lose power. and the boundaries of their lands. But according to our modern culture and views and values, are genocide and slavery not some of the more heinous extremes of what we call racism? As the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob enter the land of Canaan, they are provided with the following instructions. And to read this honestly and fully as it is written can be rather disturbing. In Deuteronomy 20, verses 10 to 17, it says, "When you march up to attack a town or a village, make the people a peace offer. Put your weapons down, and we won't kill you. If they accept this offer of peace, and if they open their gates of their cities and towns and villages for you to come in and take over everything, then all the people in those places shall be subject to forced labor, and they will work for you as slaves. If they refuse to make peace and they engage you in battle, then lay siege to those settlements." Now, before we read too quickly over this, I want to bear in mind that these people living in these various Canaanite towns and villages, cities might be a bit misleading because they weren't giant cities like we think of a city today, but as they were going about their business, minding their own business in these Canaanite villages and towns, you have everyday life carrying on. You have people who aren't looking for war, people who are raising families, teaching their kids, farmers, carpenters, bricklayers, building and constructing, young and old who have posed no threat to Israel other than being potentially willing to defend their own home territory from attack from outsiders, who in this case would be the Israelites. They just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. So it goes on in Deuteronomy chapter 20. "When the Lord your God delivers the cities into your hands," then this is the cities that have resisted the offer of peace and slavery, "if they resist, put to the sword all the men in those towns and cities. As for the women, the children, the livestock," all clumped together here, "of equal value, and everything else in these towns, you may take these as plunder for yourselves, and you may use the plunder, the women, the children, the livestock, that the Lord your God gives you from your enemies." You can use them. You can do whatever you want with them. It's up to you. You can have them as a gift, as a bounty, as a prize. "This is how you are to treat all the settlements that are at a distance from you and do not belong to the nations nearby." So this only applies to the outer cities, the ones at the edge of Canaan, not to the main central promised land. "However," Deuteronomy says, "in the cities of the nations the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, do not leave anything alive that is alive. Anything that breathes, destroy it. Completely eliminate them, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded." Now, how do we square these commands from God with a Jesus who is all-loving, all-gracious, and compassionate to everyone? And it seems at times, especially to those who are not Israelites. And how and why did the Christian church so radically backtrack from Jesus back to Moses? This is a subject that most churches would never dare touch. They probably wouldn't even want to read that passage from Deuteronomy, Because if we took what happened there into 2021, and you knew of a group of people who claimed justification for doing exactly that, and the only justification they had was they said God told them to, would you believe them? Would you think that was moral and just and right? So again, these are the questions we're wrestling with. Is it us who have changed and now we're out of line in our thinking about justice and racism? Or was there something wrong about that? And if there was, why is it in the Bible? And how do we justify that today? Today I'm going to begin a new series on racism, the Bible, and Christianity. And while it may get a little uncomfortable, nothing wrong with that, I will attempt to present the material fairly and honestly in our search for truth and understanding. We'll examine topics such as the origins of segregation and separation of peoples, Israel and extreme exclusion and concepts of purity, Israel's softening of extremism towards others, the radical inclusion of Jesus, and the radical inclusion, but with limits, of the early apostles. Then the loss of innocence and the rise of racism against Jews in particular. Then, particularly from the Middle Ages to the later, more recent times, missionary zeal, slavery, colonialism, and later attitudes towards non-white races. Then we'll look at contemporary Christian views on race. Intergenerational sin and accountability. Do we have any accountability as Canadian Christians for what our ancestral Christians did to First Nations people, for example? Or can we simply say, I wasn't there, I didn't do anything, I'm not responsible in any way? And then finally, towards a brighter future for Christianity regarding race. But what is racism? How do we define it? What are we talking about? Can the term even be applied to the values and attitudes and behaviors of people 2,000 to 3,000 years ago? Did such a thing as racism even exist back then? Well, yes, as strictly defined, race refers simply to a grouping of humans around a shared physical or social qualities into categories generally viewed as distinct by society. So in its strictest sense, it's a very general term. Basically, anyone who's different as a group compared to another group. I mean, that could include people who look exactly the same as you, but observe a different kind of religion. But today, race is more generally thought of as referring primarily to physical appearance, skin color, that sort of thing. And it includes concepts of superiority of one group and inferiority of other groups. So I think we need a more precise term. And whatever racism is, it is fundamentally, more than anything else, about differences. It's all about how we, each of us, behave towards those who are not the same as us. It's about our reaction towards those with different physical appearance, along with their different language, or maybe even just a different accent, different culture and values and beliefs, and other different views on the world. Again, this term, racism, is it even applicable to biblical times and the Christian era? Well, in my view, it really doesn't, not in the sense that we use it today. First of all, what primarily differentiated people in ancient cultures as being better or worse than others, inferiority and superiority, it was around things like population size and military strength and wealth and resources. And in the case of ancient Israel in particular, we see that while they may have looked almost identical to all the people around them in Canaan and neighboring countries, they define themselves primarily by their superior God. So in the approximately 1,000 years before Jesus and the founding of what became the Christian church, I don't think people were especially divided into specific groups based upon the color of their skin. I don't think people used terms like blacks and whites and browns. During those times, there were few, some exceptions, but there were few mass migrations of races infiltrating another race and coming into opposition with each other. Even large armies often contained people from many different regions. People from Asia never traveled en masse to Africa. People from Europe did not routinely uproot and move their whole tribe to India. From time to time, people traveled across nations and regions and territories, mostly for trade and exploration. And these people would have been seen more as a curiosity rather than as some kind of threat because of a different, quote-unquote, race. The threats generally came from the people along your own borders, from neighboring tribes, neighboring empires that generally looked more similar to yourselves. But bear in mind that during the time that Israel conquered Canaan, for example, there would only have been a world population of about 40 to 45 million people. That's only about 30 times the size of Calgary, spread across the whole globe. So we're not talking about a lot of people. We're not talking about a whole continent of millions and millions of people that all looked the same, that were different from another multiple hundreds of millions of people in another continent that came together and mixed and fought against each other. My point is that if relatively small racial groups defined by skin color and physical appearance remained relatively static and localized, then by modern standards, you can't be racist if you're not exposed to other races. Does that make sense? Let me explain it this way. When I was from birth to age 3, I lived in a one-street, tiny little northern village in Scotland. In my village, there was not one racist. Not one. And it's not because everyone was so righteous, but because there was only one race. We all looked out like each other. Maybe someone had red hair, maybe someone had brown hair. That was about as different as it got. Maybe someone had a lot of freckles, someone only had a very lot. We all had freckles. But we were all white people, mostly descended from Celtic, Picts, Gaels, and Vikings. And there was a Catholic Church and a Church of Scotland. That's where our divisions lay, mostly. But you can subdivide and subdivide people into all kinds of other groups. There were men and women, young and old, educated and less educated, those that were laborers and those that were more white-collar workers, and those that didn't work. But there were no people of other ethnic or racial origins to discriminate against, to express hatred towards, or even to choose to accept. Even after moving to Northern England in the mid-1960s, we saw no other children of other races. No families with different skin colors. My first memorable experience with race was at age 11, which is getting pretty old. And I was attending my first church summer camp. It was my first time away from home, and I was the youngest and one of the smallest campers out of a group of approximately 200. Older teens tend not to hang out with preteens. It's just not cool. But in my camp unit, there was one other small 11-year-old boy, and his name was James Naku. And James was the child of East Indian parents who had emigrated to England as part of a Commonwealth program to bring East Indian, African, and Pakistani families over to the United Kingdom. James and I became instant friends. We had very little in common, I wasn't sure why he looked the way he did. I just knew he was different. But that didn't matter because we shared a need to stick together because no one else had even noticed us. However, I want to point out, there was no special moral positive act on my part to accept James, to become friends with James, to not be divided with James. We just bonded over our need to have an alliance. If I had been one of the thousands of laborers and factory workers from Birmingham, Manchester, or Bradford, whose jobs, it was claimed, were given away to the waves of Indian immigrants for often lower wages, I would no doubt have objected to those newcomers coming from East India who looked so different from me. In other words, and this is the point, where situational needs predispose us to benefit from others who are different from us, racism is rarely an issue. But when we don't see a benefit to be gained by interacting with those who are different from us, or where we feel threatened by a particular group of people who look different from us, or where we have the power to exploit others who are different from us, then I think deep down in our heart, we are all very likely capable of racism. So what we're really talking about here is otherism. The fact that others are of a different race is almost incidental. Almost any difference can cause us or our group to reinforce our own identity by emphasizing the ways in which we feel better than others who are different from us. Perhaps a more precise term then for racism 2,000 to 3,000 years ago would be tribalism. Our tribe is somehow better. Our tribe needs to stick together. Our tribe should be wary of other tribes. We don't know their motives. We don't agree with their values. We don't have the same God as them or the same religious practices, etc. Just like racism, tribalism is about us and them. It's about what makes us unique, what makes us feel better than others, because we do, and more favored by the gods who are called upon by both tribes or all the tribes for protection, for successful harvests, for large families, for victory in battle, etc., etc. So before we explore the early origins, which we'll do next time, of segregation and separation of peoples, among the ancient Israelites in particular, I want to leave you with what I would consider a baseline principle. And a baseline principle in the Bible is important to establish because it's the principle that instructs our view on how we read the rest of the Bible and how we ought to treat, in this case, those who are different from ourselves. And by baseline principle, I mean that since the Bible is a collection of books written over hundreds of years by many different authors, you will find, if you are honest, and only if you are honest, you will find a naturally set of conflicting and contradicting values and ethics that reflect the culture of the time in which each particular author wrote that book. So what I'm saying is that sometimes we have to choose a passage to supersede all other contradicting voices, to be the one that we consider to be the most accurate voice of God. I would like to use the following scripture as my baseline because it is looking to the end of all things. So whatever else it says in the Bible, this is how things are supposed to be. This is how things, says the Bible, will be. And if it's how it should be, how it will be, then maybe we can begin to do this now. This is looking to the future, when the Lamb of God is among us. Revelation 7, verses 9 to 10. And after this I looked, and there before me was a great multitude, and no one could count it. And this multitude included everyone from every nation, from every tribe, from every people and language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. They were wearing the white robes of purity and were holding palm branches in their hands, and they cried out in one loud voice together, "Salvation belongs to our God," not his God and her God and his God, all of us, every nation, every tribe, every people, every language. Salvation belongs to our God, who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. So in the final analysis, we find in the scriptures that everyone is included. There are no others, just our people. There is no us and them, just us. And so that's how I believe we ought to live our lives today. Now, why wait for some point in the future to live out what we might call this ideal intended by God? Well, for some, the answer is that the Bible also has conflicting ideals. Ideals especially promoted by ancient Israel at times in its history. And that's how some Christians continue to want to see the world around them and the others that are different from them. And we'll pick up the story there next time.